Welcome back, podcast world. This is Andrew Bill, and I am down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. It's another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. This is just going over articles that I've read that I found to be quite interesting, actually. So, without further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. Alrighty, here we go. Let's kick it off again. Just talking about what I'm reading about, and that's about it. I'm actually doing in the middle works of doing a huge deep dive on colon cancer screening. There was a multiple request or just interactions that occurred that have inspired me to just give you all the numbers and all the facts around colon cancer screening, and that will be coming out in the next 1 to 2 weeks. So hang tight for that. And if you didn't like that one, I mean, if you didn't like the mammogram screening one, then you're probably not going to like that one. Luckily, it's only going to be a 2 or 3-parter. Just hold out about a month, and then it'll be back to its regular scheduled question medicine. And not to let the cat out of the bag too early, but Right on Prime is coming. Right on Prime is coming March 1st, and let me tell you, it is awesome. I mean, if you want to talk about getting most bang for your buck, it's everything. It's emergency room, it's family practice, it's internal medicine, it's hundreds of articles being broken down, it is board review, it is CME, it is guidelines. If you want to know about it, it is going to happen there, and it's all for a ridiculously low price. I mean, it's really just insane. But now let's get to the articles. All right, here we go. To the articles. Blood being anemia. This is interesting because not too long ago, actually, people used to say, and people not being me because I wasn't in medicine yet, used to say, well, if you're going to give 1 unit, you might as well give 2 units. And if you're going to transfuse, then you should transfuse it 10. And then it was 9, then it was 8. Now we know you don't do it until 7 unless they're having, you know, symptoms that may be a little bit higher, or they're high risk for a cardiac event, or they're going to cardiac surgery, obviously, or they're actively bleeding and their, you know, rates falling at a rapid pace. But we don't just give blood anymore. We kind of hold off on that. This paper in Annals of Internal Medicine titled Long-Term Outcomes Among Patients Discharged from the Hospital with Moderate Anemia, a Retrospective Cohort Study. This asks the questions of, all right, well, we're letting these people have moderate anemia. We're letting their hemoglobin fall. But then what happens when they're discharged from the hospital? So let's get to the basics. This is a retrospective cohort study, looked at just over 450,000 patients who had just over 800,000 hospitalizations over a 5-year period. That 5-year period was 2010 to 2014. And during that time frame, they found moderate anemia, which was defined as a hemoglobin between 7 and 10 at hospital discharge, increased from 20% of the time to 25% of the time. Remember, that's a 5% absolute increase over a 5-year time span. This is great news because that came with fewer in-hospital red blood cell transfusions. It went from 19% to 17%. As you can imagine, we're allowing more anemia, more moderate anemia, so we have decreases in the amount of transfusions that we're giving, a 28% relative decline, or 2% absolute speaking. So basically, in the hospital, we have two decisions when it comes to anemia. We can either transfuse or we can accept a lower value, as such as a hemoglobin of 7, 8, or 9. And when we're left to choose between two things, we always pick the lesser of two evils. The lesser of the two evils is obviously allowing a lower hemoglobin, because transfusion comes with side effects, or allowing a lower tolerance, at least in the studies up to 7, doesn't seem to really do that. But the big question becomes, is, are we addressing the anemia? Are we addressing the anemia either in the hospital or outpatient? Because although we're doing less transfusions, this study also found that there's an increase in the proportion of patients who were still anemic 6 months after hospitalization. However, despite being still anemic 6 months after hospitalization, rehospitalization and mortality rates were decreased compared to previous years. So we're doing less transfusions And even though at 6 months they still have anemia, they're not being rehospitalized for it, and they're not dying from it. Those are good numbers, all statistically speaking. The one thing I think that we're not addressing probably is the anemia. Why are they anemic? Likely it's iron deficiency or something of a chronic disease, which has some relations to iron in and of itself. So maybe we should be discharging all these patients on iron. I don't really know. That's not what the study found. Maybe we should be making sure that they have closer follow-up with their primary care provider to address this anemia. I'm not sure. Either way, the good news is they're not being rehospitalized, they're not getting transfusions, and they're not dying sooner because of this anemia. I give you this. Move on and move forward, my friends, and continue to allow at least a moderate anemia. And the next article I'm going to lead you into is an article in which I get to say, told you so. I told you so. It is in JAMA. It is a piece titled Breast Cancer Screening in 2018. Time for Shared Decision Making. This is an amazing piece. This says kind of exactly what I sort of said in my whole breast cancer screening part, and that is that, listen, it's 2018. It's time that we have shared decision making involving breast cancer. It's a wonderful piece, and you can go on Google and find it for yourself, and then you'll not have to listen to the rest of this little section on it. But they break down how should we have this shared decision-making conversation. They give multiple different suggestions. They give the numbers behind everything. And they also give a thing called Mammogram Theater. Mammogram Theater is on YouTube. You can find it. It breaks down breast cancer screening in a very easy, simplistic way in which you can just show your patient, here, watch this video. And if you want to have screening afterwards, okay. If you don't, okay. Because remember, although we can say, well, screening does only find maybe 1 out of 1,000, at least it finds that one. Well, sort of, but it also harms a bunch of individuals at the same time. The numbers given in this paper are that for 10,000 women screened yearly for 10 years, your risk of being diagnosed with breast cancer obviously goes up with age. But let's just look at the average 50-year-old, because the average 50-year-old is a good place to start when we're talking about the shared decision-making conversation. So 10,000 women yearly for 10 years. Out of 10,000 women, 231 will be diagnosed with invasive breast cancer. 62 women will have breast cancer death, and you will avoid 10 deaths from breast cancer because of mammography. That's pretty good, except for when you look at the fact that out of those 10,000 women screened yearly for 10 years, and you're saving 10 lives, which is awesome, you are at least going to have over 6,000 women who are going to have at least one or more false positive. You're going to have at least about 1,000 women who will have one or more unnecessary biopsy. And then obviously, you're going to have 44 women that are going to be overdiagnosed. It is not a benign thing. And even giving the diagnosis of breast cancer is not benign. Women live with this fear of, oh, I have breast cancer. I had breast cancer and I fought it and beat it. Maybe you did, maybe you didn't. That's neither here nor there, and you can go back and listen to previous podcasts to get my feelings on that. However, it is time that we have this shared decision-making conversation. And if you are using Mammogram Theater out in your practice, please let me know. I would love to hear that. I know that at least for a while, my better brain was using it in her clinic, but I don't know if she still is. However, I think it's real. I think we should be giving. It's a 2-minute video that breaks down the benefits and risks in simple terms that can be done while you're with another patient, while you're writing a note, and you don't have to then try to, well, the numbers are this and no, no. The video does a great job. Mammogram Theater on YouTube. Anyways, on to the next article.
All right. The times, they are a-changing. You see, back in the day, in my day, we used to put people in the hospital for a urinary tract infection to get IV antibiotics. IV antibiotics being the real good stuff, you see, because it gets right into the blood. It's right there in the blood. The IV antibiotics is where it's at, let me tell you. I would know. I've been practicing medicine now for about 54 years.
Well, here comes a new article in the New England Journal of Medicine titled Oral versus Intravenous Antibiotics for Bone and Joint Infection. Yeah, that's right. You heard me. oral versus intravenous antibiotics. And some would say, that is crazy. You can't do a study with oral and IV antibiotics. But they did. And let's break it down. This was just over 1,000 participants who were being treated for a bone or joint infection. So we're talking about osteomyelitis or like an infection of some joint. Within 7 days after surgery or 7 days after the start of antibiotic treatment, patients were switched. They were switched to either oral or IV antibiotics. Now, this study did not use blinding. And at first I thought, wait a second, what do you mean they didn't use blinding? That kind of throws off the results. But they put it perfectly in their paper, and I quote, blinding was not used because we considered it unethical to expose participants in the oral group to the risk associated with prolonged courses of intravenous administration of placebo. So they didn't want to give them placebo antibiotics. I totally get that. I guess I probably wouldn't have blinded the study either. Now, the primary endpoint was defined as treatment failure within 1 year. 1 year, that's pretty good. After randomization. And defined as the presence of at least one clinical or microbiological or histological criteria of failure. That's everything. Basically, if you are infected clinically, if you show that you're showing gram positive back in the bone or in the blood, if you have some sort of histological finding that says it's failed, there you go. That was the primary outcome. Treatment failure occurred in 14.6% of the participants in the IV group and 13.2% of the participants in the oral group. That means no statistical difference. But if you got IV therapy, your length of stay was 3 days longer, and there was no difference in serious adverse events. In the end, I think that the POET trial, which was that whole trial which we talked about a couple weeks back now, IV versus oral antibiotics for endocarditis, and now this trial, we can officially say we need more studies with IV versus oral antibiotics. Or maybe we don't, because we can look forward and say, hey, this seems to maybe be the real deal. Oral antibiotics are likely equal, if you have good source control, to IV antibiotics. And I think we can also say that although we may have been raised and trained that IV antibiotics are the end-all be-all, just like most of medicine, they're probably not. It was probably a made-up fallacy that we just created in our minds to make us feel like we were doing better than we actually were. IV antibiotics are probably just the same as other antibiotics, as long as you have good source control. And speaking of a good source, if you are on Twitter, then you need to follow Tony Brew, TONY_BREU. And if you're not on Twitter, then you still need to get on Twitter and then follow Tony Brew. He is awesome. He does these tutorials that are phenomenal. I mean, if you don't learn something in every single one of his tutorials, I personally will fly to wherever you're at and buy you a cake. Every single one of them are absolutely phenomenal. Learning is contagious. If you're on Twitter, follow him. Tony Brew, last name BREU. If you're not on Twitter, then get on Twitter and follow him. It is well worth it. You'll thank me later. And speaking of thanks, your patient is going to thank you when you stop their baby aspirin for primary prevention. Oh, that is right. So let's break down one new article, January 22nd, 2019, in JAMA, titled Association of Aspirin Use for Primary Prevention with Cardiovascular Events and Bleeding Events, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. Here we go. I'm so excited. Here's what we know. In 2018, we had Esprit, Ascend, and Arrive trial. Just a quick reminder on those. They basically said that baby aspirin for primary prevention is not beneficial in the elderly, the diabetic, or an individual with an increased cardiovascular ASCVD risk, or just cardiovascular risk score, depending on which risk score you're using. The risk score in that study, again, was around 18%. That's a high-risk individual. So this is for primary prevention, not secondary prevention. And this study in JAMA, again, looked at the association of aspirin for the use in primary prevention, and what happened when you had cardiovascular events and bleeding events when you incorporated this new set of evidence that has come about in 2018. Well, this was a meta-analysis of 13 trials. It looked at over 150,000 participants. It had over a million, yes, that's right, a million patient years. The median age in the study was 62 years old. The follow-up or median time of follow-up was around 5 years. The baseline cardiovascular risk was 9.2%. So not super high, but again, a 62-year-old with a 9% risk, that's pretty good. I would say if aspirin was going to help, it would probably help this patient population. The primary cardiovascular outcome was a composite, as it always is, of cardiovascular mortality, non-fatal myocardial infarction, and non-fatal stroke. The primary bleeding outcome was major bleeding and was individually defined by each study. There is good news. There is really good news. Aspirin was associated with a lower risk of cardiovascular events with a number needed to treat of 265. However, there is bad news. And if you've heard me say it once, you've heard me say it 1,000 times. You see, when the tide goes in, the tide must go back out. The door only opens so it can close. The ball only goes up so it can come down. The bad news is that there was increased risk of major bleeding, a number needed to harm of 210 compared to those on placebo or no aspirin. To say that differently, you prevent 3 cardiovascular events, but you cause 4 bleeds. I think that we can say that aspirin is probably not beneficial for primary prevention, although it could be worth having that conversation with the patient sitting in front of you, as they may say, listen, I don't care if I get a bleed maybe as often or more often than I would have a cardiovascular event, especially a non-fatal stroke. I would never want a non-fatal stroke. Non-fatal strokes are my biggest concern in life, doctor. Well, if that's the case, then maybe aspirin is for them. However, I can say I don't think it's probably beneficial overall, but who am I to decide for everyone? All right, we're getting near 20 minutes and I have a bit of a rant, and then I'll end this podcast as I've ended every podcast before it. Here's the deal. Epinephrine got a huge bit of criticism because A, it's a cheap drug, B, it saves lives, and C, the price went from a reasonably affordable $20-$50 an EpiPen up to like $150, and there was an outcry. As well, there should have been. I mean, it's cheap, it's affordable. There's no way that we should be making this $150 so no one can afford it. That is insane. I mean, I'm all for companies making profit. That's completely okay with me. However, there has to be a reasonable amount of profit that can be made, especially in a medical field when you are literally dealing with things that can save someone's life. Now, let's break down inflation. Inflation, we know, goes up 3% or more on average. Overall inflation from the last 20 years is 55.6%. Again, it's about 3% on average. You're looking at about 3%, but not everything inflates at the same rate. And we know that, right? We know that college tuition is up almost 200% during that same time span. However, televisions from 1997 to 2017, well, they're down about 100% compared to inflation. And new cars are actually about the exact same. You're getting it the same dollar for dollar that you would have got it 20 years ago. But we know hospital services are up about 225%. You get where I'm going with this. I'm sure you do. My big problem is that insulin. Yes, that's right. Insulin is up 1,171% in the last 20 years from 1997 to 2017. It's not made any different. In fact, it's made the exact same. It can probably be made in larger quantities because they probably have bigger factories to make it. But if they don't, that's okay. They still have insulin, and it is up over 1,000%. That is ridiculous. There's not a large outcry about why is the price of insulin so astronomically expensive when it's so relatively easy or should be easy to make, and it's been around forever. I mean, they literally gave away insulin to help save lives when it first came out because this was a major breakthrough. Diabetic patients, and at that time it was, you know, really type 1 diabetics, but diabetic patients were living about a year at time. And they gave, I mean, it was unbelievable. If you want to go back and read a fascinating medical history, then go read about Banting and Best and their discovery of insulin, and then how they won the Nobel Prize and how it wasn't given to necessarily both of them at the same time. And so then after Banting's death is when the Nobel Prize came out and said, oops, actually, this Best guy, he also should have got some credit for creating insulin. But I digress. Insulin's ridiculously expensive. There should be an outcry for it. I don't know why there's not an outcry for it. It is literally abusing the system, and it is, again, a medication that saves people's lives. Maybe not type 2. In fact, almost certainly not type 2 diabetics, but type 1 diabetics, it saves their lives. And I'm not sure why this hasn't been raised yet, but I will leave you with that thought. So let's go to a recap and finish up. In a recap, 30 seconds or less, here we go. Anemia in the hospital, it is a real thing, and it is not being fixed up to 6 months later, but that is okay because those patients are not coming back to the hospital and they're not dying, so who knows, but we should probably address their anemia, at least in the long term, and have a shared decision-making conversation with your patient about mammograms. I am not a thespian, but Mammogram Theater on YouTube, that's a theater I can get into right there. Check it out. Watch it. It's awesome. Oral antibiotics for osteomyelitis instead of IV antibiotics. That sounds like crazy talk, but yep, it's here. Times are a-changing. IV antibiotics are not the end-all be-all that we maybe thought that they once were. And I'm going to end this podcast on a very, very sad note. Aspirin. Date of death, 2/23/2019 for primary prevention. And now, a moment of silence. And I hear the music, so that means I'm going to end this podcast like I have ended every podcast before it. Until next time, keep the quest in questioning.